One of the main goals of quantum gravity is to provide a better description of the Big Bang and Big Crunch singularities in cosmology. And perhaps the most fundamental question is whether these singularities represent a true beginning or end of time, or whether there is some kind of bounds. Now, those advocating a true beginning include Hartle and Hawking in their wave function of the universe, and those advocating a bounce include Viniziano in his pre-Big Bang scenario, and Steinhardt and Turok in their recent discussions of a cyclic universe model. What makes this problem so hard is that any approximation you make is likely to break down near these singularities. In fact, our very notion of space and time is likely to break down. So what one would really like is a description in which space and time are not fundamental, but are derived from more fundamental quantities. So I'd like to tell you about an approach I've been developing with my postdoc, Thomas Hertog. We've been working on this for almost a year now, and three papers have come out on the web. The approach we're taking is based on the ADS-CFT correspondence originally proposed by Maldacena back in 1997. And as you know, ADS stands for anti-de Sitter space-time. This is the maximally symmetric solution of Einstein's equation with negative cosmological constant. Setting the radius of curvature equal to 1, the metric is given here, which looks pretty much like flat space with just a couple of extra powers of r squared thrown in. And you immediately see that if you rescale by 1 over r squared, infinity is a cylinder, just minus dt squared plus d omega, at a finite distance, since the distance out to r equals infinity is now finite. Since light is unaffected by conformal rescalings, this immediately tells you that light can reach infinity in a finite time in anti-de Sitter space. The other side of this correspondence is the CFT, the conformal field theory, which is just an ordinary non-gravitational quantum field theory that happens to be conformally invariant. And the ADS-CFT correspondence states that string theory on spacetimes that asymptotically approach anti-de Sitter space cross some compact extra space is completely equivalent to the conformal field theory living on the boundary. Well, this is a very powerful and remarkable statement, which has been extensively studied over the past 8 years or so. But you might ask how we can use this to study cosmological singularities. After all, the statement is explicitly concerned with space-times which asymptotically approach anti-de Sitter space. Well, the point is that if there is smooth, asymptotically anti-de Sitter initial data, which evolves to a Big Crunch, then one can use the CFT to study what happens near the singularity in the full quantum description. And by a Big Crunch here, I simply mean a space-like singularity which goes out to infinity in a finite time. So an outline for this talk is the following. I'm going to first show you that there indeed exist solutions which evolve to a Big Crunch. I'll then discuss what's known about the dual CFT description of this Big Crunch. And finally, at the end, I'd like to say a few words about a surprising spin-off of this investigation, something we call designer gravity. And I'll tell you what we mean by that when we get there. Okay, so there are many versions of this ADS-CFT correspondence. We're going to focus on the one in which space-times asymptotically approach four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space across the seven sphere. Now, the low-energy limit of M-theory with these boundary conditions is an N equals 8 supergravity in four dimensions. This theory has a lot of matter fields. There's 28 gauge fields, 70 scalars, and it's rather complicated. But fortunately, we can consistently set all the matter fields to zero except for one scalar. And so we're going to work with a theory of gravity coupled to a single real scalar field, phi. The potential for the scalar phi coming from supergravity is written here. So the potential is just minus 2 minus cosh square root of 2 phi, and I sketched it below. You immediately see that there's an extremum at phi equal to 0 in which V is negative, so anti-de Sitter space is indeed a solution. But it also looks like that solution should be unstable, because this is clearly a maximum of the potential, and indeed the mass squared of phi in terms of fluctuations about phi equals to 0 is negative. In these units where we've taken the radius of curvature of ADS to be 1, the mass squared is minus 2. But it's been known for a long time that anti-de Sitter space can be stable even in the presence of tachyons, provided the mass squared is not too negative. And this was shown by Breitenlohner and Friedman back in 1982. The reason why you don't run into trouble if the mass squared is just a little bit negative is intuitively the following. You can think of the energy of these modes as consisting of two terms. There's a positive gradient contribution to the energy, and then a negative potential term in the energy. Now, the gradient term, of course, includes the square of the gradient of phi, but this is sort of the radial derivative of phi times the inverse of the RR component of the metric. And you recall that the RR component of the metric had an extra power of R squared compared to the usual flat metric. And so that gives an enhancement of the positive gradient term over what you would get in ordinary flat space perturbation theory. And this enhancement of the positive term can actually compensate for a negative potential term and lead to stability even in the presence of tachyons. But this argument depends crucially on the boundary conditions. So all asymptotically anti-de Sitter solutions of this theory have a scalar field which falls off asymptotically like alpha over R plus beta over R squared, where R is an asymptotic radial or area coordinate, I should say, and these coefficients alpha and beta can in general depend on the other coordinates, on time and perhaps even the angular variables. Now, the usual boundary condition that people impose is that alpha should be zero, so phi falls off as fast as possible. That's the standard boundary condition for the modes in ADS. But in fact, because the mass squared is negative and this mode is tachyonic, it turns out that you can also take beta equal to zero because these modes, which go like 1 over R, are also normalizable. So in fact, both of these quantizations, both of these boundary conditions have been discussed in the literature. And in either case, if alpha is zero or beta is zero, anti-de Sitter space is stable. And that means that you will never find asymptotically anti-de Sitter initial data which evolves to a big crunch. Because in order to get a big crunch, you need the asymptotic anti-de Sitter space-time to be unstable, to be able to have some small perturbation evolve to a curvature singularity in a finite time. So we're not going to succeed in studying cosmological singularities using these standard boundary conditions. So what we want to do is to introduce a new boundary condition, which is really just a slight extension of the ones that have been studied before. Our new boundary condition is that this coefficient beta is equal to some constant k times alpha squared. This boundary condition was first introduced a little over a year ago by Hertog and Maeda. And they noted that this boundary condition shares with the standard boundary conditions the feature that it's invariant under all the asymptotic anti-de Sitter symmetries. You can see, one of the standard symmetries of an asymptotic anti-de Sitter space is that you can rescale R by a constant. And you notice that in this case, if you rescale R by a constant, you can absorb that by rescaling alpha, and this constant k is unchanged. So there's really a one-parameter family of boundary conditions here labeled by the constant k. When k is 0, you just recover the standard boundary condition beta equals 0. But what I want to convince you of now is that for any non-zero value of k, there are indeed solutions which we have asymptotically anti-de-Sitter initial data that evolve to a big crunch. See? Well, that limit of k going to infinity is actually tricky. And I don't think, if you simply take k very large, you do not get the same physics as you would if you just set alpha equal to 0. And in fact, the limit, well, as I said, for any k, ADS is unstable. When k gets very large, it's even more unstable. And so in some sense, that it's not true, I guess, that k goes to infinity is equivalent to alpha equals 0. Yeah. More questions? Alex? Yeah. Well, in three dimensions, okay, so you want to consider the same, now I don't think you get the same fall off. We'd have to sort of think about what mass you need, right, because this fall off is 3 plus 1 dimensions with an m squared equals minus 2. So it depends on both the dimension and the mass. Yes? Yes, you can define conserved charges with these boundary conditions, and I will come to that later. Right. Good. Okay, so let me now convince you that you can actually construct solutions which evolve to a big crunch using this boundary condition for any non-zero value of k. The way I'm going to do that is to explicitly construct such initial data, and we'll do that using a trick. So the trick is to start by considering the Euclidean field equations. So I'm in four dimensions. I'm going to assume an SO4 rotational invariance. Write the metric in a form which is just d rho squared over some function beta squared of rho plus rho squared d omega 3. I'm also going to take the scalar field phi to be just a function of this radial variable rho. Einstein's equations then reduce to a set of ordinary differential equations in rho. It turns out that B is algebraically determined in terms of phi by virtue of the Einstein equations. So the only equation you have to solve is an equation for phi. It's an ordinary second-order differential equation. The regularity at the origin requires that phi prime be 0 at the origin. So solutions are specified by just one number, the value of phi at the origin. Given any phi at the origin, you can integrate out and obtain a solution of these Euclidean equations. So we pick phi at the origin and integrate out. And you find that asymptotically, phi has the same fall-off as these Lorentzian solutions I was talking about a moment ago. Phi asymptotically goes like alpha over rho plus beta over rho squared. So now we define k. Okay, because of the spherical symmetry, alpha and beta are now constants, so we can define a constant k by setting beta equal to k alpha squared. And so for every value of phi at the origin, you determine this number k, and what you discover is that k is large when the initial phi is small, and vice versa. And the solution for phi is some nice monotonically decreasing function of rho, and so these are nice smooth Euclidean solutions. Now, we're not interested in Euclidean solutions. We're interested in Lorentzian solutions, but the idea now is to simply slice this Euclidean solution through the center, in other words, restrict to the equator of these three spheres, and use that as initial data for the Lorentzian solution. By construction, the time derivative will be 0 because of this reflection symmetry, and so we can get a Lorentzian solution. And in fact, the Lorentzian solution you get is just an analytic continuation of the Euclidean solution we've already constructed. And this is the same procedure that was originally discussed by Coleman and DeLucia in their gravitational instantons back in 1980. And in that procedure of analytic continuation, what happens is that the Euclidean origin becomes a Lorentzian light cone. Outside the light cone, everything is smooth. And in fact, the solution is exactly the same as the solution you would get if we go back to the Euclidean form of the metric and simply replace the metric on this three-sphere with that of three-dimensional D-sitter space. Okay, so we simply replace the three-sphere with D-sitter space here, and that gives you the metric outside the light cone of the origin. So nothing, you know, unusual is happening there. But inside the light cone, things get more interesting. The symmetry, which we started with, the SO4 rotational symmetry, turns into an SO3,1 Lorentz symmetry. And so the solution inside must be of the form of this Friedmann-Robertson-Walker universe. And you can show from the field equations that the scale factor is forced to vanish in finite time, producing a curvature singularity, which now goes all the way out to infinity, giving us the big crunch. Okay, so one indeed has, in this way, a solution which evolves to a big crunch. So here's a space-time diagram, a Penrose diagram of our solution. And I've marked the initial data, which is time-symmetric here. There's the asymptotic ADS region here. The initial data evolves to a big crunch in the future, and because it's time-symmetric, it actually comes from a big bang in the past. This region outside the light cone is the one which is in which the scalar field is bounded and everything is nice and smooth, but inside the light cone, things evolve like a cosmology to the big crunch or the big bang. Yes? Oh, yes. Absolutely. Exactly that potential. So these are solutions of gravity coupled to scalar with that potential from supergravity. Yeah. Now this Penrose diagram looks exactly like the one you would draw for a Schwarzschild anti-de Sitter black hole. So you might wonder what the difference is. And in fact, there are two key differences. One is that infinity is not complete. In a Schwarzschild anti-de Sitter solution, this boundary at infinity, in fact, is complete. It has time going from minus infinity to plus infinity along the cylinder. And the fact that it looks like a finite segment is just an artifact of the conformal rescaling that you have to do in constructing the Penrose diagram. This is not the case now. Now this cylinder really is a finite cylinder. In terms of the asymptotic metric, time only goes over a finite range. And because the singularity is going out to infinity in a finite time. Second of all, in an ordinary Schwarzschild anti-de Sitter solution, each point represents a two-sphere. And the two spheres are very large at infinity. They come into a finite size at this point and then become large again on the left. So there are two asymptotically anti-de Sitter regions, and there's this sort of bifurcation sphere in the middle, a minimal two-sphere. Again, that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is that this is really a point. It's really the origin. And there is only one sphere which sort of goes around here. And the sphere sort of starts at zero radius and goes out to infinity. And so there's one asymptotically ADS region. So in this case, what you see is what you get. I mean, it really looks correct. I mean, there's a finite boundary at infinity, and these are really a point which sort of grows in one asymptotic region. Simon? A time-like observer. Well, you see at infinity, well, what's happening is that in terms of an asymptotic global time, the singularity reaches the boundary in finite time. But as you say, there's a growing sort of factor of R squared, so that finite sort of global time can be arbitrarily large for an observer that stays at finite radius if you let that radius be arbitrarily big. So if you have a big enough rocket ship and you know, choose the right trajectory, you can live for arbitrarily long time in this space. But GD6 will not, right? GD6 are clearly incomplete. And it's just a statement that the light gets out to infinity in finite time, in global time here, and the singularity hits the boundary at that point. Okay, but you might... Yeah. Right. Well, I'm coming to the field theory. That you're exactly right, and that's the question we're going to address. Okay. Well, Mukhan just asked whether this means that the boundary conformal field theory looks like it has evolution ending in a finite time, and I said yes, and that's exactly what we're going to discuss in a few minutes. Okay, you might wonder if I've really satisfied our boundary conditions. I've taken a Lorentzian solution, analytically continued, and found this solution. But remember, the Lorentzian boundary conditions were formulated in terms of, what happens at infinity. And I haven't shown you that this solution actually satisfies our boundary conditions. So let me do that now. So outside the light cone, I've said that the solution looks like the Euclidean solution with the three-sphere replaced by three-dimensional de Sitter. So this is three-dimensional de Sitter. There's the rho squared factor. And this metric function d just goes like rho for large rho. So this is d rho squared over rho squared. Now, this metric is, in fact, one way of describing anti-de Sitter. So it's an asymptotic anti-de Sitter space. But I want to re-express this in terms of global coordinates. We need to know how rho and tau are related to the standard r and t that I had on an earlier slide. And the answer is given here. So rho squared is r squared cosine squared t minus sine squared t. It's the relation between these global coordinates and this other type of radial coordinate. And so 1 over rho is 1 over r cosine t plus something which falls off like 1 over r cubed. Now, the scalar field that we had, we know asymptotically goes like alpha over rho plus k alpha squared over rho squared. That's by construction. If you now re-express rho back in terms of r and t, you get that it goes like some new alpha tilde over r plus k alpha tilde squared over r squared, where alpha tilde is just our old constant alpha divided by cosine t. So you see, first of all, that our boundary conditions are indeed satisfied, because this is the correct Lorentzian form of the boundary conditions we wanted to satisfy, that this coefficient is k times that coefficient squared. But furthermore, you see that the coefficients now become time dependent, and in fact, alpha tilde blows up when t goes to pi over 2. Okay, so this shows that with the boundary conditions, anti-de Sitter space is indeed unstable. You can take initial data which evolves to a big crunch. This is a nonlinear instability, because if you linearize our boundary condition, you just go back to the old beta equal to zero boundary condition that people had studied before, and there's no instability in that case. Now, we're used to throwing away unstable theories and calling them unphysical, but today I want to sort of take the attitude that there should be a dual description of this theory, even though ADS looks unstable. And we want to use that dual CFT to tell us what happens to these Big Crunch and Big Bang singularities in a full quantum gravity description. Clearly, if the state in the CFT continues to evolve for all time, and one can reconstruct a semi-classical space-time metric from the state sort of at a time later than t equals pi over 2, then we would say that there's some kind of bounce, and the space-time sort of recovers a meaningful description on the other side of the singularities. But if the state doesn't have an evolution past this point, or if it does and you can't recover space-time, a semi-classical space-time, then we'll have to conclude that there isn't a bounce. So what is the CFT description? Well, it is the 2 plus 1 theory on a stack of M two-brains. Now, unfortunately, that theory is not very well understood. You can think of it as the 2 plus 1 theory on a stack of D two-brains, and then take the strong coupling or the infrared limit. Now that theory on a stack of D2 brains is known to contain an SUN gauge field and 7 scalars. And with the beta equal to 0 boundary condition, so that's the one where you require the field to go like alpha over R with no 1 over R squared term, the bulk scalar that we've been working with is dual to a dimension 1 operator in this theory, which is given by the trace of a symmetric traceless combination of the scalars. So schematically it looks like sort of phi 1 squared minus phi 2 squared. Now the modification to the boundary condition that we have imposed by requiring that beta equal not 0 but k times alpha squared corresponds to adding a term to the CFT action, which is a triple trace term. The new boundary condition corresponds to adding to the field theory k over 3 times the integral of O cubed. Now O is a dimension 1 operator, so O cubed is dimension 3. We're in 3 dimensions, so this operator is marginal and preserves conformal invariance, at least to leading order in 1 over n. But, however, it's not positive definite, right? You can see that there is a minus sign in O, minus phi 2 squared, and this is raised to an odd power. So the extra term is like adding a potential to the action, which is not bounded from below. So this is very much like, if we want to just sort of simplify this field theory, it's very much like a scalar field theory in 3 dimensions where the scalar potential has an m squared, a 1 half m squared phi squared term minus k over 3 phi to the 6. Well, the phi to the 6 clearly comes from the fact that I had that O cubed and O had a minus phi squared term in it. But this term might look puzzling because I said the theory should be conformally invariant and you don't usually associate mass terms with conformal field theories. But however, there is a type of mass term here because we're dealing with this field theory on a sphere. Just 1 second. So this is a CFT living on a two-dimensional sphere across time. So there is a the curvature coupling of the scalars for conformal invariance gives you an effective mass term. Yes, the question? Presuming marginal in what? Why is it irrelevant? Yeah, I said marginal, so you could, I mean, it's... Okay, well, all I know at the moment is that it's marginal. It's a dimension 3 operator in 3 dimensions. We can talk later about what the other effects are. Okay, so the field theory potential looks roughly like this. And so you know what happens. The phi equal to 0, which is sort of the standard anti de Sitter solution in the bulk, is a perturbatively stable vacuum. But non-perturbatively, it decays. And just from ordinary field theory analysis, you know that in a semi-classical approximation, phi will tunnel through the barrier and then roll down to infinity in finite time. This potential is steep enough that it actually reaches infinite values of phi in finite time. And parenthetically, the gravity solution we've already constructed tells us that in the full conformal field theory, corresponding to this theory on a stack of M2 brains, to leading order in a 1 over n approximation, the expectation value of phi has to diverge in a finite time because the expectation value of phi is given precisely by this coefficient alpha tilde of the 1 over r term in our gravity solution, and we've seen that that diverges in a finite time. So from this analysis, it would appear that the field theory evolution ends in a finite time, and there is no bounce through the big crunch. Well, let me just mention that this simple scalar model works surprisingly well in the following sense. We saw that from the gravity side, alpha goes like a constant over cosine t. alpha, as I just mentioned, is supposed to be giving us the expectation value of this dimension one operator O, and O is quadratic in phi. So you might try phi of t being some constant divided by the square root of t, just taking the square root of this. And it turns out that this is an exact solution, an exact classical solution of the nonlinear field equation you get from that simple scalar field Lagrangian with a phi to the sixth term in the potential. This is an exact classical solution provided the mass has the right value, but the mass required, the mass term is 1/8 the curvature of the two-sphere, which is exactly the mass term you'd expect for conformal coupling of the scalar. So, Alex? Okay, let me say now that we do not claim to have a final understanding of the CFT, and I'm going to tell you what we've done and what we understand about it, but one of the possibilities is exactly what you say, that there are modifications to the CFT that we have not included because of high gradient terms and things that should be taken into account. But, well, we'll see what might happen because of it. Okay, so I've so far told you that in a simple semi-classical analysis, or leading 1 over n approximation to the full theory, evolution seems to end in a finite time. But what about the full quantum theory? Well, the first step toward analyzing the full quantum theory is to restrict to just homogeneous field configurations. After all, the solution we have had spherical symmetry in the bulk, which means that on the boundary theory, the scalar field phi is really homogeneous, and the classical solution I just talked about is just a function of time rolling down the potential, and that corresponds roughly to our solution evolving to a big crunch. So to study the full quantum theory, let's first just throw out or ignore the inhomogeneous modes. Think about the quantization, the full quantum theory of just the homogeneous mode. Well, in that case, the field theory reduces to just an ordinary quantum mechanics problem. And it's a quantum mechanics problem in a potential, which is, again, unbounded from below. So V of x is just 1/2 m squared x squared minus k over 3 x to the 6. Now, this type of quantum mechanics problem has been extensively studied. In particular, there's a nice paper by Farhi et al. From the early 90s. And what you discover is that evolution is not really well defined without some extra input. You need some effective boundary condition at infinity in order to construct your Hamiltonian. Technically, the Hamiltonian is not essentially self-adjoint. You need to choose a self-adjoint extension. But there's only a one-parameter family of self-adjoint extensions, so there's only a one-parameter family of allowable Hamiltonians. And if you pick one, then evolution continues for all time. Once you have a self-adjoint Hamiltonian, you have unitary evolution for all time, there's no sign that evolution ends. But it is true that the expectation value of x can diverge. If you start with a wave packet, it'll roll off to infinity, but it doesn't stop. It then comes back. So that's what the quantum mechanics tells us once we've effectively picked some boundary condition at infinity. And this is looking a lot more like a bounce. So you might begin to wonder if the right answer is that there is a bounce. But the answer is no. This almost never happens in a quantum field theory. And the reason is that the CFT has infinitely many degrees of freedom, which become excited when the scalar field rolls down the steep potential. Now, this has been discussed extensively in the cosmology literature, and it goes by the name of tachyonic preheating. And I think Lev Kaufman was the first person to discuss this. Basically, what this means is just that the inhomogeneous modes are unstable. So under evolution, they become very large. They take energy out of the homogeneous mode. And intuitively, you can think about it as just particle creation. The particles are decaying into lower and lower mass particles. Now, I've just said that in the quantum mechanics problem, you have to basically choose some type of boundary condition at infinity, one of these self-adjoint extensions, in order to make the evolution well-defined. If you do the same thing in the CFT, you would find that this homogeneous mode evolves. It immediately sort of decays or produces all of these inhomogeneous modes. And you would expect the whole thing to settle down to some type of thermal state at large phi. You would certainly not expect a simple bounce, which would require all of those modes to somehow come back, join up into just the homogeneous mode, and shoot it up the potential. Yes, Steve.
So in the CFT context, you expect this to specify the theory.
Well, that's one of the things we still don't understand. Okay, we don't know if the CFT perhaps regulates itself through perhaps some sort of correction to Lagrangian involving higher gradient terms or something, or whether you have to add a little bit more input in terms of the self-adjoint extension. It's not, I'll talk a little bit more about the regulations we've tried, but it's not completely clear yet to us whether it's going to sort of fix itself or not. We don't know of we don't know where the extra information would come from. Right. Amanda? Right. Okay. So there's a long history of studying cosmological singularities in quantum gravity using what's called the mini superspace approximation. And this is an approximation in which one truncates general relativity to just a few homogeneous modes and then applies quantum mechanics to those modes. And what this has taught me, at least, is that mini superspace is a terrible approximation. You lose important physical effects, such as particle creation or this tachyonic preheating, if you restrict yourself to just a couple of homogeneous modes and not work with all the degrees of freedom. So that was just a little lesson which came out of this. Now, if for the moment we just assume that the CFT is well-defined and we'll have something like a thermal state at the end of the day, this leads to a natural time asymmetry between the Big Bang and the Big Crunch. Penrose has argued for a long time that we need such an asymmetry in order to explain the second law of thermodynamics, and it seems that something like that is coming out of this analysis for the following reason. So the evolution we've been talking about is basically a homogeneous scalar field rolling down the potential, and that corresponds to the Big Crunch. We've seen that if you start with the homogeneous mode, you will quickly produce the inhomogeneous modes, and at the end of the day, you expect to evolve to something like a thermal state. The time reverse of that, which would be the Big Bang, would require that you have some very rare fluctuation or very special initial state in which this thermal state is arranged so that it will sort of produce a lot of energy in a homogeneous mode so it can climb back up the potential. That's the time reverse of rolling down the potential and exciting all of these modes. So the evolution to the Big Crunch is a very natural generic evolution. The evolution from the Big Bang requires a very special or rare fluctuation. And one's led to the following picture of the Big Bang. The universe starts in an approximately thermal state, which we can think of as having all the Planck scale degrees of freedom excited on the gravity side. Very rarely there's a fluctuation in which most of the energy gets put into the zero mode, which goes up the potential, and that's the Big Bang. And so that might help explain the origin of the second law of thermodynamics. But as several people have reminded us, this is based on the assumption that the CFT is well defined and you can evolve down and get this thermal state. So we checked, you know, what can we do? We don't understand the CFT in detail, but suppose we simply regulate our potential by hand. Suppose we add to the CFT action a quartic term in O, so that our potential is now, our sort of action is the usual action plus a K over 3 integral of O cubed, that's the term we've been working with. But now we add an epsilon over 4 times the integral of O to the 4th, where epsilon is a very small parameter. So the potential now looks roughly like this. In this case, we know that the field theory evolution is well defined and does exactly what I've been saying. The field theory, if you start a configuration here, it'll roll down, it will excite all of these inhomogeneous modes, but we now have a nice stable ground state and it'll evolve to something like a thermal state about the true ground state. Yes? Okay, you're saying that there should be some finite temperature effective potential, and you're really sort of... Right. Well, that would be good news for us. So, I mean, there are many things, I mean, I should say that, you know, we've been thinking about and trying, and if, in some sense, this thing stabilizes because of some finite temperature effective potential, then we don't need the... you know, we actually know how to compute finite temperature. Okay, let me come back to that. But you're right. I'm not taking this literally, okay? I'm saying that this is some schematic. It doesn't have to be at this minimum. It could be shifted to some other minimum, and maybe we don't even need this thing at all. But let's just ask what happens if you try this. Okay, so the question now is, what does this modification to the field theory correspond to on the gravity side? Well, on the gravity side, it's another shift in our boundary conditions. There's a general rule for these multi-trace perturbations of the CFT, which has been discussed by Witten and Server and Schomer. And the rule is that if you add some function, W, of a single trace operator, O, to the CFT, the boundary conditions that you need to impose to implement that is that beta is equal to W prime times alpha, where alpha is the expectation value of O. So remembering what O is, it was... we can just take the derivative, and the boundary conditions we need to impose now is that beta is equal to a constant alpha squared plus the small number epsilon times alpha cubed. So that's our new boundary condition, and we want to take the same initial data and evolve and see what happens. Well, what you know immediately is that almost nothing happens, nothing changes, except in the corners of this diagram. And the reason is that epsilon is very small. So when the evolution begins, you don't see the modification in the boundary condition. And in particular, you're going to form trap surfaces and you'll get singularities and all of that. Now, there is a point when alpha, which is growing on the boundary, alpha eventually becomes very large. And when it becomes large enough, this alpha to the fourth term in the boundary condition will become important. And you'll see the modification. But at that point, causality restricts the influence of the new boundary condition to just these corners. Okay, so our same initial data will evolve. We'll get a singularity. It'll go out. There'll be this big surface, the light cone growing very big. But because the evolution in the corners can change, we now don't know that you're really forming a big crunch. And it's now possible that you form a black hole. The black hole has to be very big, because its horizon would basically have to be at least as big as this sort of light cone, and the light cone can get very big, but it might stop expanding and eventually become a horizon. So we want to know if we now form a black hole or a big crunch. Well, if you simply try the trick we used before, take the Euclidean solution and analytically continue, you're going to get the same solution we got before. In other words, that solution we've already seen satisfies our old boundary conditions. It doesn't satisfy our new boundary condition. And to really construct this solution will probably require some numerical relativity, which we haven't done. But we can at least ask whether there's a black hole with the right energy to form. So now, well, I was asked earlier about whether there was sort of conserved quantities associated with our new boundary conditions. And now let me come back to that and spend a moment talking about energy. Well, the usual notion of energy in an asymptotically ADS space-time is only finite under the boundary condition when the field falls off as fast as possible. Only when alpha is zero does the usual field theory, was the usual energy well defined. But it turns out that you can, for our boundary conditions, and in fact for any boundary condition of the form beta is some function of alpha, there exists a conserved energy. So you can always define a conserved energy, which will depend on the boundary conditions of the scalar field. The energy is always associated with asymptotic time translations, so it is a well-defined conserved energy, but it's not always positive definite. The energy of our initial data turns out to be zero. And that's exactly what you should expect, because we obtained the initial data by finding a Euclidean solution. Although I haven't emphasized it, this Euclidean solution is really an instanton mediating a quantum transition from pure ADS to this sort of solution I've been describing, which evolves to a big crunch. Okay, so since it has, it's sort of an, the something, it's a state that the ADS solution can decay into, it should have the same energy as ADS, namely zero. Okay, so this modified notion of energy is well defined. It gives us zero energy for our initial data. And so the question is, do zero mass black holes exist in this theory? And the answer is yes. So these are, of course, black holes with scalar hair. We have non-trivial scalar field outside the horizon. And what I plotted here is the mass of the black hole versus its Schwarzschild radius, R0. There are two branches of solutions. This upper branch was first discussed last year in a paper by Hertog and Maeda. This exists even when epsilon is zero. In other words, even before we regulate the potential, just with the usual ADS invariant boundary conditions that I've been talking about before. And in fact, in that case, if epsilon is zero, this branch just continues indefinitely. So there's arbitrarily large black holes with scalar hair. Their mass is always positive, and in fact, it's always bigger than the Schwarzschild ADS black hole with the same radius. But when you regulate the potential, you discover that there's another branch of solutions with a much lower mass, and that's this lower branch. These solutions have negative energy if they're small, and they have positive energy when they're big, and in particular, there is a zero mass black hole in this theory. And so this is the likely end state of our initial data. You can, in fact, interpret these two solutions as saying this is the black hole corresponding to excitations above our true ground state. The sort of thermal states about our true ground state give rise to these black holes. And these black holes correspond to excitations above the maximum of the potential. You might think that that's unstable, and indeed, these black holes turn out to be unstable. So, and they also have more mass than Schwarzschild, which is consistent with the fact that they're starting with excitations about a positive mass ground state. Okay, so we found a black hole, and what happens is that as epsilon goes to zero, as you turn off the regulator, this curve, this lower curve, just moves down and out. So this becomes farther, more negative, and it crosses the axis at a larger and larger value of R0. So as you take epsilon to zero, the radius of the final black hole diverges and becomes the big crunch. So the conclusion of this part is that if you just naively regulate the theory by putting in this O to the fourth term by hand, you produce a very large black hole and not a big crunch. Okay. And so one, you know, needs some better ideas and some better understanding of the CFT to pursue this further. But let me go on now and say, well, what happens if you look at the small radius limit of these solutions? You notice when the radius of the black hole goes to zero, the mass doesn't go to zero. So these solutions are not approaching ADS when the horizon shrinks to zero size. They're instead approaching a static, smooth soliton in this theory of gravity coupled to a scalar field. And in fact, we noticed that the masses you get here and here are precisely the value of the potential at its extrema. So we had a potential here with an extremum which was positive, and the potential with a negative minimum here. And these values of the potential were precisely the masses of the solitons when you take the horizon radius to zero. So this is what led us to this idea of designer gravity. So the claim is the following. Given any function, any potential V of alpha with lots of maxima, minima, whatever you want, there are boundary conditions so that this theory of gravity coupled to a scalar field with its supergravity potential, so that this gravity theory has solitons precisely at the extrema of V with masses given by the value of V at the extrema. In other words, you can pre-order solitons in this theory. You can pick where you want the solitons to be and what masses they should have, and there's at least some boundary condition which will reproduce that. And I want to emphasize that the bulk theory is not changed. I'm not changing the bulk potential in any way. It's the same theory we've been working with all along. I'm only changing the boundary conditions. And this now has several consequences. The first is that there are new positive energy conjectures for asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetimes. The energy of all solutions in this theory should be greater than the global minimum of V. So the energy is not always positive, but if this function, V of alpha, is bounded from below, the energy, we suspect, will always be bigger than the lowest mass soliton. Amanda? This is the soliton? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's perfectly smooth. It's a soliton. It's a static solution. It's not an S-brane. S-branes tend to be time-dependent. So it's just static, spherically symmetric, smooth configuration of scalar field and gravity. It's like a boson star. It's like a boson star. Okay. It also turns out that one can compute an effective potential. And so using these solitons, you can compute an effective potential for this operator O in the dual field theory with the modification to the action appropriate for this function. So let me just say another word about this, and then I'll wrap up. So in a little more detail, the way you find these boundary conditions is the following. There is a soliton for every choice of phi at the origin. So in much the same way that we were talking about those Euclidean solutions, you can assume the metric is static and spherically symmetric. The scalar field depends only on R. You now have ordinary differential equations again. The derivative of the scalar field has to vanish for regularity at the origin. And so you have just a choice of the scalar field at the origin. You integrate out, and you get the right fall off that it goes like alpha over R plus beta over R squared. So varying phi at the origin, you find a particular alpha and a particular beta from the asymptotic value of the soliton. And so that gives you a curve. Beta is a function of alpha, which we call the supergravity curve or the soliton curve because it comes from these solitons. So then the rule, which you can check, works, is that if you define a function W naught by just integrating this curve with respect to alpha from 0 up to alpha, and then given any V, you write V as this particular function W naught plus something else, and choose boundary conditions where beta is equal to the derivative of W. Then you can show that beta equal to this beta supergravity is an extremum of V, and the mass of the soliton that you get is just given by the value of V at the extremum. So there's a very explicit construction for how to choose boundary conditions so that you get solitons where you want them. Okay, so let me wrap up. The summary is the following. I first showed you that a small change in the standard boundary conditions for this asymptotically ADS solution with this tachyonic scalar allows smooth initial data to evolve to a big crunch singularity in string theory. We've then discussed what's known about the dual CFT. It has a potential unbounded from below. Semi-classically, the evolution just ends in finite time. If you do a full quantization of the zero mode, that, of course, exists and describes a bounce subject to some choice of self-adjoint extension. But the analogy, if the same thing were true in field theory, should be a type of thermal state. And that leads to this picture of a time asymmetry between big bangs and big crunches. If you explicitly regulate the potential by hand, you form this large black hole, which becomes a big crunch as you take the regulator away. We clearly don't understand the CFT completely, and as many people said, there's more work to be done here, perhaps including finite temperature effects or higher gradient effects, etc. Finally, there exist supergravity solutions with pre-ordered solitons, and I didn't discuss this, but you can do exactly the same thing with black holes. You can choose boundary conditions to give you hairy black holes with exactly the masses you want. And it's a construction very similar to the soliton. All right, I'll stop there. Thank you.